If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
Hello and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Crime with Holly. It's your girl, Holly, and I am back today with another solved murder case for you all. I need to give a massive shout out to my girl, Myrtle, for being the research genius behind today's case. She dug in deep to provide me with all of the details to bring you guys today's episode. And if you're a fellow podcaster and are looking for a researcher or writer, I highly, highly recommend Myrtle. She has worked for some serious powerhouses within the community, and she is a top-tier, thorough researcher and does an amazing job. I will be sure to tag her on Instagram so you can go follow along with all of the shows that she is involved with. Major thank you, Myrtle. You are the best. You guys, the true crime community this week has been in-freaking-sane. I was thoroughly invested in the Lindsay Clancy murder trial, and I am not shocked that the trial ended in a mistrial. But I am shocked that the trial ended in a mistrial because of only one singular juror. That was something I didn't see coming, and the fact that the juror was holding out for a guilty verdict was even more surprising. To hear that 11 other jurors were on the side of the not guilty was not what I had anticipated at all. I figured the split would have been like 9-3, 6-6, something, but I was not expecting an 11-1 vote. I was covering that case from start to finish on my personal Facebook page, so if you're not following me over there, you're missing out. If you join my private Facebook group, Crime with Holly Podcast Discussion Group, you'll be able to find all of my posts in there. I tried to break things down in terms that is easier to understand for the average Joe like myself, because sometimes all of that legal mumbo jumbo can be confusing. So make sure you give me a follow. I think I'm going to start posting a lot more true crime content over there. And I just want to say sorry to all of my personal friends who aren't big into true crime like me. You're just going to have to deal. Okay, so let's get to the real reason that you are all here. Today's episode is on the tragic murder of Ashanti Billy. On September 29th, 2017, a landscaper was mowing the grass behind East Stonewall AME Zion Church in Charlotte, North Carolina. He noticed some really bad smell coming from somewhere behind the building. At first, he couldn't figure out where exactly it was coming from, but as he looked around, he noticed something in the tall grass near some of the large boulders along the fence line. He thought maybe it was like a dead deer, maybe a coyote, something other than what it really was. So he grabbed another guy and the two of them went over to get a closer look. But when they got closer, they moved the tall grass to the side. They realized that it wasn't an animal. It was the partially nude and badly decomposed body of a young woman. Obviously, this was a shock, and they immediately called 911. Reverend Michael McLean, who was the leader at the church, later told News 13 that, unfortunately, crime wasn't uncommon in the area. they had found things behind the church before. Typically, it was things like drug paraphernalia, discarded clothing, other garbage, and things that had been dumped there. But they had never found anything like this before. And when investigators arrived, the scene they found was disturbing. The woman was lying on her back on top of a piece of plastic sheeting with her legs spread apart. Her arms were stretched above her head and tangled inside a dark-colored sweatshirt and shirt. She was still wearing a sports bra and had socks on, but there were no pants on her body or anywhere nearby. Her body had been there long enough that decomposition was advanced. Some of her skin had begun to mummify, and in some places of her body, her bones were actually exposed. Near her head, investigators found a pair of underwear and a plastic glove. But at this point, they had one very important question that needed answered. Who was she? The scene was chaotic, as you can imagine, and the FBI even came in to assist in the investigation. As they were processing the scene, the news came in that there was a missing woman who fit the description of their Jane Doe. The missing woman was 19-year-old Ashanti Billy, and she had been missing since September 18th, 11 days before the body was discovered. Ashanti had gone missing from Norfolk, Virginia, over 300 miles away from Charlotte, North Carolina, where this deceased woman was found. That was a significant distance from where she went missing to where this body was found. But obviously, it wasn't impossible, and so they had to thoroughly investigate this lead. Sadly, the following day, it was confirmed that the body was Ashanti. Now, let's talk about Ashanti Billy and who she was. Ashanti was born on May 13, 1998 to her parents Meltoni and Brandy Billy. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of information readily available about her younger years, but what I do know is that she had big dreams and goals for her future. Ashanti was also a military brat. Both of her parents served in the army, and so she was used to moving around and had lived in many different places growing up. In August 2017, after graduating high school, she picked up her life in Maryland and moved to Virginia Beach to attend the Art Institute of Virginia Beach to study culinary arts. Ashanti loved to cook and bake, and she had dreams of opening her very own bakery one day. So moving to Virginia Beach to attend this culinary arts program felt like the next step to achieving her goals. Now, Ashanti had suffered from seizures and had been diagnosed with epilepsy. And because of that, she herself could never serve in the military like her parents. But she loved the military community. And so being in Virginia Beach near the Joint Expeditionary Base Little Creek Fort Story almost felt like home away from home. Ashanti quickly found a job on the military base working at a sandwich shop called Blimpy. And it was from her work that Ashanti would go missing. It was on Monday, September 18th, 2017, that Ashanti Billy woke up and got ready for work. She put on her black work shirt and a black zip-up hoodie and dark-colored pants, grabbed her things, and left her Virginia Beach apartment. She got into her cream-colored 2014 Mini Cooper and headed toward the Blimpy sub shop. Normally, Ashanti wouldn't have been going to work this early, but that morning, she was scheduled to come in 3 hours ahead of her normal shift because the restaurant had a health inspection later that afternoon, and Ashanti was supposed to go in and do a deep clean of everything so it was ready for the inspection. At 4:44 that morning, security cameras at gate 3 of the base captured Ashanti's Mini Cooper driving through the gate. But almost immediately, she had to turn around. Apparently, there had been a car accident just inside of the gate that was blocking the road. So at 4:46 a.m., just 2 minutes after she entered, her car was captured leaving the base. 12 minutes later, at 4:58, the Mini Cooper showed back up, this time entering through gate 1. The cameras never got a clear enough view to positively identify the person behind the wheel, but whoever was driving appeared to be wearing dark-colored clothing, which obviously is consistent with what Ashanti was wearing when she left the house that morning. At around 5 a.m., another camera captured her car circling the blimpie. And then there's a gap. For more than 30 minutes, we don't know exactly what happened. But at 5:33 a.m., Ashanti's Mini Cooper appeared on the Gate 1 camera again. But this time, it was leaving the base. And something had changed. The person behind the wheel now appeared to be wearing light-colored clothing, and it didn't appear that anyone else was inside the car. A few hours later, at around 8 a.m., one of Ashanti's co-workers, Andrew Estrada, arrived at the blimpie and immediately knew that something wasn't right. The building was dark and Ashanti wasn't there, which he knew that she was supposed to be there opening and cleaning. She was reliable, she was punctual, and being hours late for work without saying anything wasn't like her. Ashanti had been raised by two military parents, as I've mentioned, and being on time had been drilled into her since a very young age. Now, I will say there is a saying within the military that if you are not 15 minutes early, you're late. And if you're arriving on time, you're extra late. And that is how Ashanti lived her life. So Andrew called her cell phone, it rang a few times, and then a man answered the phone. It wasn't anyone that Andrew knew. This man explained that he had found the phone inside a construction dumpster in a parking lot. The phone had been in perfect condition, fully charged, and he thought it was strange that someone would throw away a perfectly good cell phone. So instead of leaving it in there, he held on to it, hoping the owner or someone looking for the owner would eventually call. Andrew knew something seriously was wrong. Police were contacted and eventually they retrieved Ashanti's phone from the man who had found it. Later that same day, Ashanti never showed up for class at the Art Institute either. And that is when Ashanti was officially reported missing. Police quickly put out a Be on the Lookout, also known as a BOLO, for Ashanti's cream-colored Mini Cooper. 5 days later, on Saturday, September 23rd, police received reports that her car had been spotted in the Ocean View area of Norfolk, about 6 miles from the base. But the car hadn't just gotten there. A resident named Greg told the Virginian Pilot that he had actually noticed the Mini Cooper sitting there on Monday, September 18th, the same day that Ashanti disappeared. He remembered it because something about the way it was left was very strange. The car wasn't parked properly against the curb. The windows were rolled down about halfway, and the doors were unlocked. Strangely, the key fob was sitting right there on the passenger seat, almost asking someone to steal this car. At the same time, Greg assumed it probably belonged to someone visiting one of his neighbors, so he didn't think much about it. But now police knew this was Ashanti's car, and once they started processing it, they found something even more concerning. Inside the rear compartment of the Mini Cooper were Ashanti's pants. One of her shoes was still caught inside of the pant leg, almost like the pants and the shoes had been pulled off at the same time. There was also dirt and debris inside the pants that investigators believed was consistent with them being removed while Ashanti was outside and on the ground. Underneath the car, investigators found even more dirt and plant debris, suggesting the Mini Cooper had been driven off-road at some point. Crime scene technicians also processed the car for fingerprints. They found just one partial print. Other than that, there really weren't any other prints. And investigators believe there was a reason for that. Someone had wiped Ashanti's car down. At this point, investigators still had no idea where Ashanti was or who may have been responsible for her disappearance. One week after she vanished, on Monday, September 25th, the FBI officially took over as the lead agency in the investigation and offered a $10,000 reward for information that could help find her. 2 days later, the Blimpy, where she worked, matched that reward, bringing it to $20,000. And I just want to say that's amazing that they stepped up trying to help how they could. On Thursday, September 28th, a group of volunteers went out searching near the area where Ashanti's cell phone had been found 10 days earlier. And it was during that search that they found something that immediately caught their attention. A piece of clothing and several hair braids that appear to have been dyed red. Now, Ashanti wore her hair in braids, and in the photo on her driver's license, some of those braids were dyed red. And while this discovery was important, it was incredibly hard for her family. For 11 days, her family waited for answers, and when news finally came that Ashanti had been found dead 300 miles from where she was living, her parents were completely heartbroken and distraught. Meltony and Brandy were still living in Maryland when they got the news. Brandy later told WUSA 9 News, quote, "I still feel numb. I feel like it's a nightmare and I just keep going to sleep and waking up to the same nightmare over and over again. We have to bring this person or persons to justice so this doesn't happen to anyone else. We also still need to face the fact that she was abducted from a military installation, somewhere we thought would be a safe location," end quote. So after Ashanti's body was discovered, it was sent to the Mecklenburg County Medical Examiner's Office in Charlotte. She was positively identified through dental records and a rose tattoo on her thigh. By the time Ashanti's body was found, decomposition was so advanced that her remains were considered partially skeletonized. But investigators were still able to collect some evidence. They took DNA swabs from the skin that remained, as well as from her teeth and fingernails, and samples of her hair were collected for additional testing. Some of Ashanti's teeth were no longer in their sockets, but the medical examiner believed that they most likely had been dislodged while her body was being recovered, not because of an injury that happened while she was still alive. Her fingernails also caught investigators' attention. Some of them had been broken, and there was some type of material underneath them. Exactly what that material was, or whether it could tell investigators anything about what had happened to Ashanti, wasn't immediately clear. Toxicology testing was also done, but no drugs or alcohol were detected in her system. And unfortunately, because of the condition of Ashanti's body, the medical examiner couldn't positively determine exactly how she had been killed. Dr. Jonathan Privet ultimately listed her cause of death as undetermined trauma, which basically meant that they knew Ashanti had died as the result of some type of trauma, but they couldn't exactly pinpoint what that trauma was. And that leaves us with a pretty big question. How did we get here? How does a 19-year-old woman leave her apartment early one morning to go to work, disappear from a Navy base in Norfolk, Virginia, and 11 days later, her body is found more than 300 miles away behind a church in Charlotte, North Carolina? Who took Ashanti? What happened to her during those 11 days? And why did whoever did this take her so far from home? As the investigation into the disappearance and murder of 19-year-old Ashanti Billy intensified, the FBI started talking to Ashanti's co-workers at Blimpy. They wanted to know if there was anyone who regularly came into the restaurant specifically to see her. Ashanti did have a boyfriend, but investigators were able to rule out the possibility that he had anything to do with her disappearance pretty quickly because he was away at Army basic training in South Carolina when she vanished. But her coworkers did tell investigators about another man. This man was named Eric Brian Brown. Eric had worked as a day laborer when the Blimpie was being built during the summer of 2017. But even after that job was finished, he continued coming around. And he came around a lot. There was a laundromat in a building near the Blimpie, and according to Ashanti's co-workers, Eric was there so often that some of them actually thought he worked at this laundromat. But what really stood out to them was the way Eric acted around Ashanti. Because according to her co-workers, he gave them major creeper vibes. They said that Eric would flirt with Ashanti while she was working, make sexual advances towards her, and make inappropriate comments about her body. One co-worker specifically remembered Eric making a comment to Ashanti about her quote-unquote big ass. Another remembered Eric saying that he thought the bands would make her dance. And if you're not familiar with that phrase, which I'm going to be honest here, I had no dang idea what that meant, so I had to look it up myself. But apparently, it's a reference to the Juicy J song Bands a Make Her Dance. Bands is slang for stacks of money, and the song is referring to throwing money at strippers. So essentially, Eric was making another sexual comment about Ashanti, suggesting that if someone had offered her enough money, she would dance for it. And obviously, none of this proves that Eric Brown had anything to do with Ashanti's disappearance and murder. But now you have a man who had been around her workplace constantly, who her co-workers remember making repeated sexual comments towards her. And Ashanti had just vanished from the very same workplace, the same area in which this man frequented. Eric Brown needed to be thoroughly looked into. Now that Eric was on the FBI's radar, investigators started digging into his background. And pretty quickly, they started finding some things that were hard to ignore. A confidential witness told investigators that Eric had made some pretty disturbing comments about African American women. According to this witness, Eric had said that he hated black women because he believed they were quote-unquote gold diggers, obsessed with social media, and only interested in men who had money. He also made comments about black women buying wigs and dyeing their hair. Investigators also spoke with some of Eric's former construction co-workers. Remember, Eric had worked as a day laborer on the construction of the Blimpie where Ashanti worked. His co-workers said Eric didn't have a car, so sometimes he would ask them for rides home. Except they never actually took him to a home. Eric would always ask to be dropped off at some random parking lot. None of them remembered ever taking him to a physical house or apartment ever. And there was something else that they thought was incredibly strange. Even though Eric supposedly didn't have a car when his co-workers arrived at the job site in the mornings, Eric would sometimes already be next door at the laundromat waiting for them. But probably even more interesting was what happened after September 18th. Before Ashanti disappeared, Eric was around that area constantly. Her co-workers saw him all the time. After September 18th, he basically disappeared. None of the restaurant employees or Eric's construction co-workers remembered seeing him hanging around the Blimpie or the neighboring businesses anymore. And then investigators discovered something that made the connection to Ashanti's case a whole lot more interesting. Eric Brown could easily get onto the base because he was retired Navy. He had served more than 20 years as an information systems technician in the Navy, working with computer networks and communications technology. Investigators obtained Eric's DD-214, which is essentially the paperwork documenting a service member's discharge from the military. And on that paperwork was Eric's home of record. He was from Charlotte, North Carolina. Yep, that is exactly where Ashanti's body had been found. But it gets even crazier. The address that Eric had listed was 1517 Crawford Drive. That house was only 300 yards from East Stonewall AME Zion Church, the church where Ashanti's body was found. Like, what are the chances? Investigators learned that the Crawford Drive house had belonged to Eric's family, although it had since been foreclosed on. Eric also had a brother, but the two reportedly hadn't spoken in more than 3 years. And when investigators talked to his brother, they learned another detail. As children, Eric Brown and his brother had attended Vacation Bible School at the same church where decades later, Ashanti Billy's body would be found behind the building. And even though Eric's family no longer owned the Crawford Drive house, investigators found that mail addressed to Eric Brown was still being delivered there as recently as September 2017, the same month Ashanti disappeared and was murdered. At this point, there was a whole lot of coincidences starting to pile up, and it was hard to ignore. But investigators still needed evidence connecting Eric to Ashanti on the morning she disappeared, and about a month later, they got a huge break. On October 27th, a man who lived near the construction dumpster where Ashanti's cell phone had been found turned over surveillance footage from his home. And the video showed something investigators desperately needed to see. A cream-colored Mini Cooper pulled up into the frame. The driver got out, walked over to the dumpster, and threw something inside. Investigators believed they were actually watching the moment Ashanti's cell phone was discarded. But there was a problem. Unfortunately, the video wasn't clear enough to identify the person's face. So investigators in the media asked the public to watch the footage closely. Maybe someone would recognize the person's clothing, their body movements, anything. And there was one thing in particular that stood out about this individual in the video. The way that this person walked. It was distinct enough that investigators hoped somebody who knew this person would recognize that walk and come forward. And sure enough, somebody did. A few days later, after the surveillance footage was released, a construction worker contacted investigators. He said that the person in the video looked very familiar, not because he could see this person's face, but because he recognized the way he walked. And then he also noticed the light-colored clothing this person was wearing. Those clothes looked familiar too. In fact, the coworker believed that they were clothing that he had personally given to one of his coworkers. And I'm sure you can all probably guess who that coworker was. Eric Brian Brown. Investigators kept digging into Eric Brown's movements around the time Ashanti disappeared, and one of the first things they looked at was his activity getting on and off Little Creek. They requested the base entry logs and found that Eric had entered through Gate 1 on September 14th. Investigators went back and pulled the surveillance footage from the day and confirmed that, yes, it was Eric Brown coming onto the base. But here's where those records get a little tricky. There was no record showing Eric leaving the base after that. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that he stayed on the base the entire time. Actually, when you enter a military installation, you have to show identification. Typically, it's like a military ID or a veteran ID, and that is what authorizes you to be on the base. But when you leave, you don't have to show any kind of ID again. You just drive out the gate. So there wouldn't necessarily be a record of Eric exiting unless there was video footage of it. What investigators did find was another entry for Eric at Gate 1 on the afternoon of September 19th, the day after Ashanti disappeared. Next, they started digging through Eric's cell phone and financial records, and this is where things get really interesting. Eric used his cell phone pretty much every single day throughout the month of September, except for one day. September 18th, the day that she disappeared. There was no data usage from Eric's phone that entire day. Absolutely zero. Investigators could see activity from his phone on Little Creek from September 14th through the evening of September 17th. He had even done some online shopping at around 4 p.m. on both the 16th and the 17th, with both purchases traced back to an IP address on base. And then his cell phone went dark. When his web activity picked back up on September 19th, some of the things that he was searching were pretty concerning. He searched phrases like, quote, police looking for man, and things like Norfolk police looking for man in connection with homicide. He also searched for things involving missing people, including, quote, Amber Alert September 2017, missing woman and baby, and missing woman and man. Then on September 21st, Eric started looking at news out of Charlotte, North Carolina. And this is why this is important. So that happened on the 21st. Ashanti's body hadn't been found in Charlotte yet. In fact, it wouldn't be found for another 8 days. The following day, September 22nd, Eric searched for JEB Little Creek Blimpies and information about the parents of a missing college student. At this point, investigators clearly wanted to know what Eric was doing. So on September 27th, law enforcement began physically surveilling him, and what they saw was incredibly strange. Eric spent basically the entire day and night of September 27th into the 28th curled up in a chair in a TV room of the gym on the Norfolk Navy base. He slept there, and when he wasn't sleeping, he just sat there watching television for hours. Eventually, sometime that afternoon, Eric finally got up. He went into the locker room, showered, changed his clothes, and walked out of the gym carrying a backpack. Investigators were thinking, okay, this dude is finally going to go somewhere. But instead, he just started wandering around the base. There didn't seem to be any real destination or purpose to where he was going. He walked between different buildings, tried opening car doors, and even attempted to flag down vehicles as they drove past him. Eventually, Eric made his way to a 24-hour laundromat on the base and went to sleep there. When he woke up, he left the laundromat and went right back to wandering around. But by September 29th, Eric had made his way into Virginia Beach and stopped at a Hardee's. And apparently, the surveillance team wasn't quite as undercover as they thought they were, because Eric walked right up to their vehicle and confronted one of the officers. After that, he went inside the Hardee's and stayed there for several hours. Eventually, he left and went to another laundromat. And listen, I don't know what is with this man and laundromats, but apparently if there was a laundromat nearby, Eric Brown was going to find it and gonna hang out there. At around 7:45 p.m. on September 29th, Eric walked into a McDonald's just down the road from the Hardee's and laundromat where investigators had been watching him. While he was there, he met a woman who was known to police as a sex worker. Now, what happened next comes from the statements that this woman would later give investigators. She said that she and Eric went back to the Econo Lodge, where she had a room there. She said that Eric had asked her for a quote-unquote date, which basically it meant that he wanted to pay her for sex. She asked if he had money and condoms. Apparently, he didn't have either of those things because she sent him out with a little shopping list. She needed cigarettes, cash, and condoms. And remember, investigators are still watching him this entire time, which is kind of crazy to be trying to purchase sex when you've already approached officers about potentially following you. Maybe they swapped cars so he thought that they left, but I just found that little tidbit kind of weird. This guy clearly isn't the brightest bulb in the box. The surveillance team followed Eric to a gas station where he bought cigarettes and then watched him return to the motel. But when he got back, the woman realized he still didn't have any cash, so she sent him right back out. Eric found an ATM, he withdrew some money, and returned to the Econo Lodge. But by the time he got back, his plans for the night had fallen apart. The sex worker told him that some of her family had shown up and that they couldn't use her room anymore. Eric had a bag with him and he asked if he could leave it in her room. She agreed because she assumed that he was going to rent another room at the motel and they would meet up later. Instead, Eric headed back out and started wandering around the same general area he had been in all day. Investigators continued following him at a distance as he cut through wooded areas and crossed onto private property. Then, at around 4:15 in the morning, Eric started walking up and down the entrance and exit ramps of the freeway. At that point, officers had seen enough. They considered what he was doing a safety hazard and detained him for trespassing. And as soon as officers approached him, Eric completely clammed up. He wouldn't tell them who he was, he wouldn't answer their basic questions, and according to one of the officers, Eric's skin felt ice cold to the touch. That concerned them enough that they called an ambulance. While they waited, officers searched Eric and found his wallet, which contained his ID. That was ultimately how they confirmed his identity, because Eric still wasn't talking. They also documented everything else that he had with him. Inside his wallet was $60 in cash, credit cards, and several customer loyalty cards. In his pocket, officers found keys, a cell phone, and an unused condom. And they also found a used condom. Could you imagine pulling these items out of this man's pocket and finding a used condom? That is so disgusting, and it grosses me out to think he was just waltzing around all day with that in his pants pocket. I would have hated to have been that officer that had to frisk this man. So Eric was taken to the Norfolk County Jail, where officers began going through the standard booking process. And apparently, somewhere along the way, Eric decided that he was ready to start talking again. One of the questions they asked was simple. Where were you born? Eric answered Charlotte, North Carolina. But he didn't just leave it at that. He volunteered that he, quote, goes back and forth from time to time, end quote. Excuse me? Because remember, Ashanti's body had literally just been found in Charlotte. And now, without investigators even asking him about Ashanti, Eric had not only connected himself to Charlotte, he volunteered that he traveled back and forth there often. When investigators asked Eric for his current home address, he gave them an apartment complex in Norfolk. There was just one problem. Investigators couldn't find anything connecting him to that apartment. Actually, they couldn't find a legitimate current address for Eric in any of the law enforcement databases they checked. Investigators eventually came to believe that Eric was essentially homeless. He appeared to move between different buildings on and off Norfolk and Little Creek bases and kept his belongings scattered among several lockers investigators located both on and off the base. And none of that by itself was illegal. Eric was retired Navy, so he was authorized to access the military installations. Police were able to arrest Eric on charges of solicitation of prostitution and something called frequenting a body place. I didn't know what that meant, so I had to look it up, but apparently it's an actual Virginia law, and yes, it can still be used. Under Virginia law, a body place is essentially a place being used for prostitution or other lewd activity, and visiting or staying at one for those purposes can be charged as a Class 1 misdemeanor. So for now, these charges gave authorities a reason to keep Eric in custody at the Virginia Beach City Jail while they continued investigating Ashanti's case. And while Eric was sitting in jail, he apparently had a pretty disturbing conversation with another inmate. The inmate later went to authorities and told them what he had said. At one point, the inmate mentioned having a problem with a female witness who had turned him into police. Eric responded with, quote, someone should pay her a visit, end quote. And that wasn't the only violent thing Eric allegedly said during this conversation. According to the inmate, Eric also told him, quote, there ain't nothing like the first taste of blood. Sometimes it makes you do things that are unexplainable, end quote. And then just to make the entire conversation even creepier, Eric apparently told him that he had done some serious stuff. Meanwhile, investigators were finally getting a chance to sit down and question Eric about Ashanti. He was read his Miranda rights, but Eric waived his right to have an attorney present and agreed to talk. Investigators asked if he had seen or heard anything unusual on Little Creek on September 18th. Eric said no. He did, however, say that while he was at the laundromat, he remembered seeing a news report about a quote-unquote disappeared girl. So investigators asked him directly if he knew Ashanti Billy. Eric acted surprised. His response was basically like, oh, that's the girl's name? As if this was the first time he had ever heard the name Ashanti Billy. Yeah, okay, I highly, highly doubt that. A couple of weeks later, investigators interviewed Eric again. Once again, he was read his Miranda rights. Once again, he declined an attorney. And once again, he agreed to talk. This time, investigators wanted Eric to walk them through exactly what he had been doing on September 18th, the day that Ashanti disappeared. Eric told them that he had walked from Gate 5 toward Gate 3 that night. But according to him, once he got near Gate 3, he magically blacked out. And not just for a few minutes or a couple of hours. Eric claimed that he couldn't remember what he had done for the next several days. So when FBI agents started asking him specifically about Ashanti's abduction and murder, Eric basically gave them the same answer over and over again. He couldn't remember. He couldn't tell them whether he had done anything to Ashanti, because according to him, he simply didn't know. Now, that's convenient, right? Right. And there was something else interesting about the route Eric said he had been walking that night. The road between Gate 5 and Gate 3 continues toward Gate 1. And Gate 1 was the gate closest to the blimpy where Ashanti disappeared. But investigators weren't going to have to rely solely on Eric's memory, or lack thereof, for much longer. DNA from Ashanti's body and clothing had finally been processed and the results were back. On November 2nd, investigators received those results from the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Crime Lab. There was an unknown male DNA profile on the zip-up hoodie and shirt that had been found on Ashanti's body. Investigators compared that DNA to a sample taken from Eric Brown, and it matched. Now let me just tell you how strong this match was. According to the lab, the probability of randomly selecting someone other than Eric Brown who would match the DNA profile found on Ashanti's hoodie was approximately 1 in 2.7 quadrillion. I'm not going to lie, I don't even know how many zeros go into quadrillion, but I'm going to go ahead and guess that it's probably more than a dozen. It's a really big number. And the DNA found on Ashanti's shirt, that match wasn't quite as strong. That one was only about 1 in 720 billion, which is still extremely strong. That's a strong match, but it wasn't no nearly 3 quadrillion. At this point, investigators didn't just have a man who had made inappropriate sexual comments toward Ashanti. They didn't just have a man who regularly hung around her workplace and then suddenly stopped showing up exactly the day that she disappeared. They didn't just have a man whose cell phone went completely dark that day, or a man who had ties to Charlotte, or whose childhood home was about 300 yards from where Ashanti's body was found, or who had attended vacation Bible school at the exact church where her body was discovered, or whose former coworker believed he recognized him in the surveillance video showing someone dumping Ashanti's cell phone. Now, they had Eric Brown's DNA on the clothing found on Ashanti's body. On November 7th, 2017, Eric Brian Brown was formally charged in connection with Ashanti Billy's disappearance and death. The federal charges included stalking, assault, including assault with intent to commit aggravated sexual abuse and sexual abuse, theft, and kidnapping resulting in death. But before this case could ever make it in front of a jury, there was another issue that had to be dealt with. Was Eric Brown even mentally competent to stand trial? The court ordered Eric to undergo mental health evaluations. According to Wavi 10 News, a mental health evaluation was ordered because of Eric's erratic behavior, what were described as, quote, deeply troubling statements that he had made to FBI agents, and other unusual behavior documented by prison staff. Court records also revealed that Eric had attempted suicide while being held in federal pretrial custody. And as doctors began looking into Eric's medical history, they discovered that his mental health issues went back nearly two decades. Eric had experienced his first documented psychotic episode in the year 2000, while he was still serving in the Navy. He was hospitalized and diagnosed with schizophrenia and treated with two antipsychotic medications. Eventually, doctors determined that Eric was mentally stable enough to be discharged. He wasn't prescribed medication to continue taking after his release, and he actually remained on active duty in the Navy for another 11 years without another documented incident like that. Eric eventually retired from the Navy in 2011, but sometime around 2011 or 2012, his mental health apparently became a concern yet again. His sister petitioned to have him involuntarily evaluated after Eric began exhibiting paranoid behavior. Fast forward to January 2018. After evaluating Eric, a Bureau of Prisons clinician diagnosed him with schizophrenia with catatonia, along with paranoid and disorganized features. There was another major problem. Eric consistently refused to take psychiatric medications. Ultimately, the court determined that Eric was incompetent to stand trial. And just to be clear, being incompetent to stand trial does not mean someone has been found not guilty by reason of insanity. Competency is about whether a defendant at that point in time is capable of understanding what is happening inside the courtroom and can meaningfully participate in their own defense. The court determined Eric could not. So he was sent to the federal medical facility at Butner in North Carolina for additional evaluation and treatment. And things did not exactly go smoothly. On May 25th, Eric managed to wiggle his way out of a chain restraint and reportedly squared up like he was about to hit one of the guards. The guard ordered him back into his restraint, and Eric was basically like, "Nope, make me." Eventually, doctors gave him a dose of an antipsychotic medication, which thankfully calmed him down. But a few days later, on May 31st, Eric's defense attorney filed an emergency motion asking the court to stop doctors at Butner from medicating him against his will. On June 4th, the court denied that motion, but temporarily ordered doctors not to forcibly medicate Eric until the court could fully determine whether involuntary medication was appropriate. A hearing was held on June 21st, and after hearing the evidence, the court determined that involuntary medication was necessary. Eric had been classified as a danger to himself or others and as gravely disabled. So doctors were allowed to continue administering psychotic medication even though Eric refused to take it voluntarily. But even with the medication, Eric wasn't immediately ready to stand trial. In July, doctors evaluated his competency again, and once again, they determined that Eric Brown was incompetent to stand trial. So the judge ordered another 4 months of treatment. By September 2018, there was at least some hope that things were moving in the right direction. Doctors believe that there was a substantial probability that Eric could eventually regain competency with continued treatment. He had even improved enough to be transferred out of the most secure area in the facility and into a less restrictive, semi-locked unit. Come October, Eric was being allowed out of his cell and into some of the common areas. But he was still experiencing some pretty significant symptoms, including auditory hallucinations and paranoia. So while there was progress, it was considered very minimal progress. In November, the court decided Eric needed to remain at the federal medical facility at Butner for another 4 months, with his competency scheduled to be reconsidered again in February 2019. And while this back and forth over Eric's competency was happening, a family from Chesapeake, Virginia came forward with their own story about him. Nakia Moore told 13 News Now that her family had actually known Eric Brown for decades. Back in the 1990s, Nakia's mother worked at a collection agency where Eric was employed as a security guard. Nakia described her mother as basically being this big mama at the workplace, the person who looked after everybody. And apparently, she especially looked out for Eric. So years later, in 2016, when Nakia's mother learned that Eric was homeless, she invited him to live with their family. And according to Nakia, Eric could actually be incredibly helpful. He worked on home improvement projects around the house. He helped organize the family's taxi business. He even attended church with them on Sundays. But Nakia also started noticing some things about Eric that made her uncomfortable. He said he was extremely focused on the nutritional value of food, talked about different conspiracy theories involving the government, and frequently went to motels for what he called dates. And at one point, Eric made an extremely inappropriate sexual comment to Nakia. He asked her if she wanted to, quote, see his black snake. And yes, he meant exactly what you think he meant. Gross, I know, that poor girl. But Nakia said it wasn't just his comments that bothered her. She also noticed the way other people seemed to react to Eric. She described getting a negative vibe from just watching some of his interactions with other people. Eventually, Nakia's brother Terrence, who worked as a merchant marine, returned home from sea. And when he found out that Eric Brown was living in his parents' house, he freaked out. Terrence told his parents that Eric needed to go. Meanwhile, the legal roller coaster over whether Eric would ever be competent enough to stand trial continued throughout 2019. And in December, it basically came to a battle between experts. One expert for the government and one for the defense each had their own opinions about how Eric should be treated and whether medication could restore him to competency. And this is where something called the cell ruling comes into the picture. The name comes from a 2003 U.S. Supreme Court case called Cell versus United States. Basically, the Supreme Court established four factors that courts have to consider before the government can forcibly medicate a defendant with antipsychotic drugs for the purpose of making them competent to stand trial. And in Eric's case, the court ultimately found that all four of those factors favored the government. The court also determined that Eric wasn't competent enough to voluntarily agree to and follow his own treatment plan. So the government was allowed to continue treating him involuntarily with antipsychotic medications. And still, there was no trial. In September 2020, the issue was considered again, and the cell order allowing Eric to be involuntarily medicated remained in place. So think about where this case stood at that point. Eric Brown had been charged back in November 2017. Investigators had DNA evidence linking him to clothing found on Ashanti's body, but they still couldn't put him on trial because he remained incompetent to stand trial. And based on the last court information available in the sources that were found for this case, Eric has remained in federal custody receiving psychiatric treatment, with the criminal case essentially on hold or unless he could be restored to competency. Meaning years after Ashanti Billy was murdered, her family are still waiting for a trial. Even today, nearly 10 years later. Through all of this, the investigation, the competency hearings, the years of waiting, Ashanti's parents, Meltoni and Brandy Billy, were still trying to figure out how to live without their daughter. And one of the things that made Ashanti's murder even harder for them to understand was where she had disappeared from. Meltoni told WY Daily that he and Brandy had actually felt comfortable with Ashanti working at the Blimpie because it was located on a military base. They thought that she was safe there. After all, both of them had served in the Army. A military installation was probably one of the last places they ever imagined something like this could happen to their daughter. And heartbreakingly, they were wrong. There was actually a really special reason Ashanti wanted to work at the Blimpie on base to begin with. As I mentioned earlier, Ashanti had suffered from a seizure disorder as a child. She knew because of her medical history, she would never be able to serve like her parents. So working on base was her own little way of giving back to the military community, which just makes what happened there even more heartbreaking. After learning more about Eric Brown, particularly that he appeared to be homeless and spent significant amounts of time moving between different locations on military installations, Meltoni and Brandy questioned how he had been able to basically live around the base without security intervening. Meltoni also said Ashanti had never told them about Eric or his inappropriate comments and harassment her coworkers later described. Her parents had raised Ashanti to be independent. They taught her to handle the normal challenges life threw at her and to come to them when something became too much for her to handle on her own. For whatever reason, Ashanti never told them what had happened with Eric, and there was no way she or her parents could have known how much danger she may have actually been in. But Meltoni and Brandy weren't going to allow Ashanti's story to end with what happened to her. They wanted something positive to come from an unimaginable tragedy. So they created the Ashanti Foundation and established a scholarship program in their daughter's name. But they also wanted to fix a problem they had discovered firsthand when Ashanti disappeared. Ashanti was 19 years old. That meant that she was too old for an Amber Alert, which is designed for abducted children. But she obviously wasn't an elderly missing person who would fall under a Silver Alert either. Ashanti fell into this huge gap in the middle. And when every minute mattered, her parents realized that there wasn't a nationwide alert system designed to rapidly notify the public about a missing or abducted adult like their daughter. No emergency alert suddenly popping up on somebody's cell phone. No immediate nationwide system pushing Ashanti's picture and information out to the public. So Meltoni and Brandy decided to fight for one. They began pushing for legislation that would create an alert for missing adults, particularly adults who had been abducted, were endangered, or disappeared under suspicious circumstances. And they wanted it named after Ashanti. The Ashanti Alert. Virginia became the first state to establish the Ashanti Alert System in 2018, and later that same year, federal legislation was signed into law creating a framework for a national Ashanti Alert Communications Network. So even though Ashanti never got the kind of nationwide alert her parents desperately needed when she disappeared, other families potentially could. And I think that is such an important part of Ashanti's story. Because when you hear everything that happened to her, it would be really easy to remember Ashanti Billy simply as a 19-year-old woman who drove onto Little Creek one morning and never came home. But that's not who she was. Ashanti was a daughter. She was a college student studying culinary arts. She dreamed of opening her own bakery. She was raised by two military parents and wanted to find her own way to give back to the military community when she couldn't serve herself. She had an entire life ahead of her. And because Meltoni and Brandy refused to let their daughter become just another name attached to a horrible crime, Ashanti's name became attached to something designed to help bring other missing people home. As for Eric Brian Brown, the criminal case against him became tied up for years over the question of whether he could ever be mentally competent enough to stand trial. And that means this case ends in a way that no family should have to accept, without a trial, without a verdict. And without Ashanti's parents ever getting the chance to watch a jury decide whether the man accused of taking their daughter's life was guilty or not. But while the court case may have stalled, Ashanti Billy's name did not. Her name lives on through her family, through the work done in her memory, and through the alert system her parents fought to create after discovering the devastating gap that existed when their own daughter went missing. And hopefully because of Ashanti, another family will someday get the one thing Meltoni and Brandy never got. The chance to bring their loved one home. And you guys, that is the story of Ashanti Billy. Thank you all so much for listening. Make sure that you are a part of my private Facebook group. You can find it by searching Crime with Holly Podcast Discussion Group. In there, I share all information and pictures pertaining to the cases that I cover, and I also encourage all members to share all things true crime. You can also follow me over on Instagram at CrimeaHolly. And if you would like more true crime content, I swear I'm going to start making content again on TikTok. So find me over there at crimewithholly.podcast. All right, you guys, I will see you next time. But until then, always remember to be aware and take care. Bye-bye.